What about the value of currency under such a system in terms of its recognition by governments abroad and by businesses trading abroad? I mean, how would the actual currency that's in use within such a system obtain respect and value in the international system?
Well, the value of money, and this is in any system, the value of money is a function of the total production of a nation and the amount of money in circulation. And this is what determines the value of money, and this is all that determines the value of money. Mm. So the usury does not create value of money, and you can debase a currency by making it inflate. Eh? So if you start printing money, then prices will decline if everything else remains the same. And if you have a interest-free money supply in a interest-free based economy that is productive, and these economies will be very productive, I can tell you, the value of these currencies will be very, very highly respected, because there will be no inflation, no deflation. There will be a stable amount of money in circulation, and for this money, high-class products can be acquired. And this is what gives money its value, that you can actually buy stuff with it.
Okay, and would you see currency as being related to, within the European context, being related to nationhood? Or do you see it at a more local level?
What I foresee is that currencies will more and more will be used to express identity in the ways that we have already been discussing. So we have the identity on personal level, family, tribe, nation, race, global. And on all these levels we exist, and on all these levels we can have different forms of money. And I think there is every reason to believe that that we will have nations for as long as there will be human history, and that there will also be competition between nations. But, and this is very important to me as a spiritual man, that also from the understanding that all nations were created by the same power and are loved by the same power, and that we must compete in righteousness and not in the desire to dominate each other. But we must, of course, be assertive in our own rights, in terms of where we live, and that we have a right to protect our women and our offspring and our race and etc. and our culture, and that we have a right to be proud of what our ancestors left us with. But there must be also brotherhood, and this is, I think, what becomes possible if you have an abundant economy, because what we see now with capitalism ripping apart the third world, not only the West, but also the third world, and creating all these streams of migrants, for instance, immigrants and emigrants. And these people are being destroyed everywhere. And if we can stop exporting imperialism through capitalism, which is what the West is doing, we can also stop giving these people the awful life that they are leading there. And there is no need for antagonism based on artificial scarcity.
Okay, so you want to repatriate economic sovereignty, in essence, and your means of doing this is control of money supply. Yeah, that more or less sums it up. Would you?
Absolutely.
Okay. Absolutely. Okay. I know you don't like centralization, you said, but would you see central government as having a role in terms of directing investment of a free issued currency, a debt free issued currency, into, say, capital projects, welfare system, and general government expenditure, or is that too centralized for you?
There is a great threat of over centralization there, but I do see a role for governments. I mean, the huge nanny state that we now have nowadays is disgusting, and I think we really, really need to push that back. And that the government must maintain a limited position aimed at, first and foremost, the defense of the realm, and a basic legal system, emphasizing basic legal system. So let's do away with 95% of legislation that we have now. But government does have a number of roles. One of the things is that it must defend the commons, so air, land, water supply, things.
Yes.
And must avoid that private or international interests start eating away from the commons. Yes. And government has completely betrayed us in that respect, and that is one of the reasons that I have a very profound distrust of government. Government has been overtaken by the plutocracy, which is now raping the commons.
Yes,
and,
but just to interrupt for a bit, I mean, I see this time and again when I talk to people who are distrustful of the state, particularly. They don't normally say just the government, it's usually the state. And I try to tell them, look, the state or government is a tool, and the relevant standard for it is the degree to which the interests of the people are emergent in its functions. So I'm quite interested in the state. I'm not against it in any way. It's just the people that operate it that bother me.
Well, I can go along with you to some extent there, but I do think that you underestimate the basic problem of the state, which is power centralization. And the power centralization is problematic because power corrupts. Mm. And people are...
So they say.
Yeah, well, I think this has been, to me, this is a given. And I think each human being is capable of wielding some power, and it is dependent on our development as as an individual, how much power we can handle without starting to seeing it as an end instead of the means. And I think there is always a grave risk of over-concentration of power in the state, because this power has to be controlled by ultimately a very small number of people, because state is hierarchy. Mm. It's unavoidable that that this is so, and therefore we must always be very, very careful of centralizing power in the state. However, there is a desire, and this is also what Daniel was talking about earlier, to do things together. We must work together as a people, and there are certain common interests that we need to organize in a reasonable way. And it is very easy to see how organizing these things together quickly starts clogging together in the state again, because the state is then where the common purpose and common interests should be theoretically be organized from.
Yes, that's right. I mean, you know, I'm a nationalist. The attitude of nationalism towards the state is that it is the place in which all the interests in society are vested. And I'm not a fascist, but you know, one of the most misunderstood statements about this was, in fact, Mussolini, when he made his commonly understood, misunderstood statement, you know, everything inside the state, nothing outside, and so on. And he wasn't referring to the sort of might of the state. I think he was referring to the capacity it has as a recipient and agent for all the interests that exist in society. And in that regard, I mean, sorry, go ahead. Yeah, I mean, if you wanted to jump in.
Yeah, because this is really a very fascinating subject and really very close at the core of my work, because, you know, in monetary reform, it's often said, listen, the problem now is that money is private and we should nationalize it, for instance. And I don't really go along with that automatically. I'm not against it either, but I don't go along with it automatically. And one of the things interesting here is you call it, you say Mussolini, but let us see what happened in Germany in the 20s and 30s. You had the 25-point program by the National Socialists. You're probably aware of that.
Yeah, I've read it,
Yeah, in the 20s you had this this program, this manifesto that was created by Hitler and Gottfried Feder. And the 25 points of National Socialism, in which they decried unearned incomes, Jewish control of public life in Germany, and a number of measures that should be taken to resolve the situation. And the 25th point of this program was, for this, a powerful state is necessary. And this was the 25th point, and this is what they set out to do once they got into power, Adolf Hitler and the National Socialists. And they did create a very strong centralized power. And this state quickly assumed very totalitarian control over daily life in Germany, yeah. Because, for instance, young people were sent into the Hitlerjugend to be formed as good Germans in the view of Adolf Hitler and his people. But I don't really think that, should I have been living at the time, that I would have been very happy with Berlin deciding what
no,
my
no,
children
no, no.
should
be. But well, the important thing is that we don't necessarily, when we look at things like National Socialism, have a good exemplar of what is possible. You know, I look at the possibilities that exist in nationalism as opposed to liberalism, and I see a completely different range of potentials. And I refuse to just judge anything by what we've actually experienced, and what will be regarded by many on the left, certainly, as being all of nationalism. I don't see it in that way at all.
Let me make very clear that I was not suggesting that you automatically assume everything National Socialist is great. Eh?
No.
But we were discussing the role of the state.
Yeah.
And National Socialism is an excellent example of at least a try to get rid of.
It became corrupted. I accept your point.
But there was also this basic philosophy, the idea that private capitalist power can be combated by strongly centralized national status power. Mm. And this basic idea, this is what I am very weary of, and I think that the main drive should be that the answer to strong centralized power is decentralized power, and there is a role for the state and there is a role for the nation, but it must be in balance with the needs of the individual. And this is where we stand also with each other, all together, thinking about these issues. What is this balance? How much can we rely the state on to do? How much must we leave to the common man and the personal responsibility of people to decide and do?
Yeah.
And this is what we're searching and trying to understand.
There is a clear division, isn't there, when one looks at this? If you think in terms of human psychology, even in liberalism, you see it expressed, but there are these two great streams of human concern, which is concern for the individual, and then concern for the group. And it really seems to me to be a bit of a no-brainer that the state has a duty to preserve the freedom of the individual to pursue his own concerns, but it also has the responsibility to pursue the interests of the group. And you know, I don't think it's difficult to operate from that general model and then, you know, see where things fall. Certainly that would be the nationalist model that would differ from National Socialism, which was so very authoritarian and didn't represent take an interest in individual rights very much at all.
Exactly. That's the whole key issue, and that's where the nationalists, especially in the United States, with the revisionists there, they are too. They simply do not see this authoritarian nature of National Socialism, and these Americans would not have liked to live in National Socialist Germany with a heavy-handed state. I'm quite positive of that, and
No. They're
naive about these things.
But there are intermediate levels between the individual and the state as well, which would allow for different what we're calling human ecologies or ways
yes.
of life to experiment with different ways, which would seem to be necessary with Anthony's program to flesh out the different possibilities for these economic programs to experiment with the realization.
Well, there are, but I mean, if you're saying basically, you're looking at localism and perhaps even at families, economies at the level of the family. I don't know.
Well, how about regions, as they would correspond states? You know, in the United States,
they want
different states so that if you like this way of life, you could go to that state or that state, and that would correspond to the regions within the nations of Europe.
Well, if you're looking at what you call a DNA nation, you know, then you'd have to say that the regions have to be placed within that DNA structure, wouldn't you?
Within Europe, but then there's places for diaspora as well. It's a bit complicated, but yes.
Yeah, but I think you know, I think it's a false dichotomy to say either localism or the state. I think both are necessary, and If you look at a big country like Germany, for instance, there's a huge difference between the way of life in Bavaria or in Hamburg. And
right.
There's a long established, centuries old regional arrangements and identity and a way of life. And nationalism in the 19th century actually was very much directed against regional autonomy, and a lot of regional structures were willfully destroyed to avoid this competition for national to consolidate this this regional power in a, on a national level. And I think I'm firmly convinced that the dark side itself was behind this movement.
Don't we see these regional differences as a good thing and not necessarily mutually exclusive to the state?
No, exactly.
But they can function together.
But there must be respect for regional autonomy and for regional identity and also for regional economics. And I don't see why a nation, which is a larger group, and it's not only a group of individuals, but it's also a group of local. It's also a group of groups, and these groups within the nation have also a right to exist and a desire to express their identity.
If you're going to make it a formal structure, then you're going to introduce levels of competition that may not prove.
Yeah, yeah. One thing that concerns me about it is like this Imperium Europa platform is that. I see something suspicious about their emphasis on the regions, that it could be a way of larger powers to manipulate.
Yeah, dominance, yeah. Local dominance through local competition, isn't it?
Isn't there some truth to the idea that it's imperialism that creates war, not nationalism?
Yes, correct.
Yeah, well, yes, there is true. I agree with that. But nationalism itself can be very imperialist also. But it must be said, and there's no doubt about that, that imperialism, as we've seen in the last 500 years, that was capitalism. There's simply no doubt about it. If you look at what capitalism, how it arose in first in Amsterdam, then migrating to Britain in the 17th century, late 17th century, and then moving on to the United States. That was the real imperial power that ruled over the last few hundred years, and that was just capitalism.
Makes sense to me.
But if you take away capitalism as the supreme force in the world, then you will see nation states with their own imperialist designs. There can be little doubt about that. But this is also a part of the reason why I'm so anxious of keeping state power under control, because the state is where the national power is consolidated, and if the state is then in turn controlled by, you know, groups within society, either the rich or industrialists or, you know, the traditional groups that control the state, they will probably seek to assert to project their own power through the state elsewhere. And this is really a basic problem of the state
It's not a problem of the state, Anthony. It's a problem of the philosophies which have been formative in the state or formative of the state. But we've moved a long way away from where we were. Let's try to get back a little bit to some of the more practical elements that we could talk about. What powers of government do you think should obtain, particularly in relation to currency and investment? What actually do you see a government doing in this new landscape that you would wish to effect?
Yeah, well, in the first place, the defense of the realm, as we've been discussing, and a basic legal system, but also I believe that it's a key obligation and duty and also opportunity for government to operate a decent monetary system. And in history, you have the basic conflict between sovereign money and international money. And international money is gold-based, or traditionally was gold-based. Later, of course, they rolled out a complete credit-based economy all over the world, but it was still the internationalist force. And the states used to print money in terms of debt-free money and then spend it into circulation, and then the money would just circulate and basically ad infinitum for eternity. But the main problem of this kind of
money
was...
Does money circulate?
Yeah, well, you can have an interesting chat about these things also, indeed. Does money circulate? Well, I mean, for all tax and purposes, I think it's reasonable to say it does. It does have a number of practical and theoretical implications, this question, but let me just continue along this this thing that I was going to say, but let's keep that in mind, that question. But you had this basic conflict between sovereign money and internationalist money. A very good example is when the Bank of England was opened in 1694. Before then, you had the tally sticks, that was the money of the British realm. And this was basically just a wooden stick circulated by the king. And the first thing that the Bank of England did was take this money out of circulation and replace it with gold coin. And that's a very good example of how you see how national money was replaced by internationalist money. And the next step in our evolution, monetarily speaking, I think, and also for the state, is that the sovereign monies of the past were debt-free units spent into circulation by the state. But the problem of these units was that they could not provide interest-free credit for normal people, because the problem is that once the state spent the money into circulation, the money would become the property of somebody, and at some point would become a bank deposit. Yep. That's what's happening nowadays. The money, once it's spent, it's just a bank deposit, and then the owner of the money will not lend it out interest free. And the problem is that the problem with usury is that the rich have money and the poor don't, so the poor borrow and the poor pay to the rich, and this is why usury also always redistributes from the many to the rich, and why it is so concentrating power all the time. And this is the basic problem of the sovereign monies of the past, and the money of the future is that the government must create interest-free credit-based facilities and money creation through interest-free credit, where normal people can go for interest-free mortgages, interest-free business loans. And this means, and what this means is that the people will spend their money into circulation, right, and not so much the government. However, the government does have a task in coordinating the economy. For instance, you have infrastructure that you need to organize, and this you cannot, you know, you cannot let the free market do this like the libertarians would like us to believe. That is impossible. There must be central coordination, and this is clearly an example of where you would want to see a well-organized central state organizing high-tech infrastructure, good infrastructure for further economic development. But I think that this must be seen as independent from the money creation process itself. This is not automatically so, because in terms of sovereign money, you would expect the government to print money and then finance infrastructure projects with that. That's the classical,
yes,
debt-free money kind of proposal.
Yes.
Banking, and this is what I would like to see, is interest-free credit-based economy for the normal people, and then the state taxing the people, and then using
spending
that money. And then,
okay. So in other words, you would want to maximize the distribution of money. You would want to not go down the route of government injecting money through capital projects, because it's too centralized again, and it's too narrow in its distribution.
Yes, but also it will take away this investing potential from the people. That's the whole issue, and the money power should be with the people themselves. However, because the money power is with the people, they can invest and they can create and produce, and therefore they become very productive, and the state can use some of that production and take in some of this production through taxation, and then use this for infrastructure building and the projects that we've been discussing, also okay, space exploration and what have you.
Have you ever given any thought, Anthony, to what kind of politics? I'm talking about, you know, some man arguing for this cause and some man arguing for that cause. What would be the political dynamics in this world? Have you given any thought to that?
Yeah, well, you know, one of the questions then is, if you have the state who is going to organize infrastructure, one of the things I would not like to see is a small group of top guys in one source of capital or another deciding we're going to do this or that, and then buy their project from their own buddies in the transnational cartel,
yeah,
who can then build the whole thing.
Yeah, and that's that goes without saying.
Yeah, that goes without saying, but I'm using this as an introduction to answer your question.
Okay, sorry.
Because then an alternative would be that you would have the intelligentsia in the community who come with plans and start creating waves surrounding these plans and start building popular support for this. And then you can have competition between these plans within the society, and people can inform themselves about these plans, and there can be referenda, for instance, or people coming together on political platforms to promote these plans. But I would like to see a very strong bottom-up kind of building of these plans within the nation.
Would you see a situation developing within the polity of one section of society seeking to perhaps the less productive sector of society seeking to advantage itself against the more productive, or do you think that would be impossible?
I think that in a natural economy, everybody can find ways of providing for himself and his family in a reasonable way.
Yes.
There will be difference, but I think that the power will always be with the more productive people in the society, and this is just. This is the way it should be.
Yes.
And I don't really see... I think the main worry is how to make sure that the productive part of the population does not dominate the lesser productive part. That is the main worry, not the other way around.
Okay.
Anthony is saying that the place to begin is with intelligentsia bringing various plans, but then I'm wondering if he anticipates what the powers that be, antagonists, might do in response and how we might protect ourselves and anticipate that.
The question is clear, and this really touches on the most fundamental issue that is underlying everything. And that issue is that most people are just completely oblivious to what is going on in the world, and these people are therefore very easily manipulated, and that is what we see in society, and that's the reason why we're all slaves after all. I mean, the reason for this is that very, very few people actually know how things work in the world, and they exploit this knowledge. And to be honest, I don't really see how humanity can escape this pit that we're in without a more general awakening, which is primarily spiritual and secondly political. Mm. And as long as people just live their lives away in a materialist kind of mindset and think that they can plausibly surrender their responsibilities and their duties to higher powers within the nation or within the system, without asserting their own rights, their own creative potential, their own individuality. We need more people doing that, and what we need people who start doing that more from a selfless way. As long as people who are ambitious go into the political domain and do this only to assert themselves, then we will continue to have problems. I don't really see how people can do without a spiritual awakening.
Okay, there's just one other area that I'd like to explore a little bit. You spoke very early on about your interest in localism and in the freedom of the individual to affect his own life. And that's obviously a good objective to have, but I'd like to know how you actually arrived at that point. Did you arrive at it from a sort of libertarian perspective in any way? Do you have classical liberal sympathies?
Well, you know, obviously I've been profoundly influenced by a number of major strands of thought. Libertarianism is absolutely not one of them. That's
right.
One I despise, and I've written much about to rebut it.
Good.
But there is a very fundamental strand in Western thought. It was already visible in the Great Invasion of the Persians in Greece, where the Persian Empire was run as a centralized empire with the emperor on top. And the armies that were driven to Greece were all slaves, and they were whipped all the way from Persepolis to Athens to project Persian power. and the Greek men who came together to defend their ancestral lands, they were not forced to do so by centralized government. They were forced to do so by personal duty and by a personal desire to defend what was what they thought rightfully so their own. And this basic conflict between the individual coming together to do something which is in the common interest, but from the from a personal sense of duty, against a behemoth that is built on collectivism, that is a very basic conflict that we see throughout human history and that we see today also. And my where I come from the profoundest sense is basic spirituality and the spirituality of Jesus, of Buddha, of Lao Tse. The basic idea and the fact, which I know for a fact, that we can have a personal relationship with the divine and that the divine speaks to us directly and that this voice is the ultimate voice for each man and that he cannot allow, that he has the duty not to allow anybody, not a foreigner, not the state, not his wife, nobody, to interfere, to let anything interfere with that, and that he must act from that ultimately.
Well, that's quite an unexpected answer. I did not, you'd said earlier, you've used the word spiritual a few times. I did not expect to encounter that. I'm quite encouraged by it in a way, because I do think that you're speaking of something that is close to the kind of thinking which I've been trying to develop myself, and which has a beautiful logic to it. I think that that point is a fine place to stop. Anthony, thank you very much indeed for your time and interest.
I want to thank you both as well. I as I see it, Anthony's views can correspond with the views that I'm promoting. Thank you both.